will notice that natural theology consists of those theologically significant propositions formulated by unaided human reason. Some would add, formulated by human reason as it views general revelation. That is not generally the way that it's formulated in Roman Catholic theology, because Roman Catholic theology does not distinguish between general and special revelation. Roman Catholic theology instead speaks of revelation. And the distinction made in Roman Catholic dogma is not between general and special revelation, but between reason and revelation, or reason and faith. Thomas Aquinas is the theologian of the Roman Catholic Church, the theologian par excellence. Thomas Aquinas wrote two great works, his Summa Theologica and his Summa Contra Gentiles. The first was intended to be a compendium of theological dogma. The second was intended more as a manual for missionaries who were working in Spain primarily and were facing Islam and Jewish theology. And so this is the shorter work, the Summa Contra Gentiles. It's been translated a number of times into English. Both works are available in English. I happen to have a Doubleday image set of the Summa Contra Gentiles, and it's four paperback volumes. The Theologica is much larger. One of our former graduates who's now on our board, Elio Cucuro, gave me a set of the works, these two works of Thomas Aquinas, a set written in Latin and published in Rome. And I have that set, and it's very nice. It's a little easier to read it in English, however. Well, both in the Summa Contra Gentiles and in the Baltimore Catechism number 3, there is a distinction made between levels of truth that are attainable by man concerning God. Now, the way you read the chart on the bottom of page 111 is, you read it, level 1 is really at the bottom. I know it's put the opposite, 1, 2, 3, but that's just numerical order. Level 1 is at the bottom. Truths attainable by unaided reason. What would be something like that? Well, on page 112, in Baltimore Catechism question 22, it asks, can we know by our natural reason that there is a God? We can know by our natural reason that there is a God, for natural reason tells us that the world we see about us could have been made only by a self-existing being, all-wise and almighty. We can know that by reason, unaided by revelation. Level 2 truths are truths attainable by reason, without any help, but because most of the people in Thomas Aquinas' time, and still most of the people in the world today, don't have the time to spend studying philosophy and theology and thinking through and reflecting on these particular matters. These truths, level 2, are more easily attainable and graspable through revelation. And so God has revealed them. I mean, you could know them through reason, but usually you have to have some special preparation and a fair amount of time to reflect upon these things. So God has revealed them, even though they're attainable. What's an example of that? Well, on page 112 in question 23, in the expansion, which you find in Baltimore Catechism number 3, you don't find it in 2 or 1, you notice that in that second paragraph, it suggests that five lines down, well, six lines down, other truths, for example, the immortality of the soul, while not beyond the power of the human mind, are objects of revelation because God has revealed them in a supernatural way. Although these latter truths could be known without revelation, they're grasped with greater ease and certainty once God has revealed them. Level two truths. Good example is the immortality of the soul that they mention. So, level one truths attainable by reason alone would be the existence and something of the attributes of God, something of God's characteristics. Particularly, they mention self-existence, wisdom or omniscience, and God's omnipotence. God is wise and he's powerful. Level two truths, example, immortality of the soul. That could be known and is known by those who study these things, philosophers and such. But God has revealed them and it's therefore more clear and more certain. Level three truths are truths you cannot attain to by reason. I mean, there's no way to arrive at them by reason. So God has revealed them to us. And on page 112, under question 23, the second paragraph, line 3, some revealed truths, for example, the mystery of the Blessed Trinity, are strictly beyond the power of the human mind. We could never know such truths unless God revealed them. So the doctrine of the Trinity is a good illustration of level three truths. Now, there are others in each one of those levels, but these are good to have something, some little hook, so that if you could say, can you give me, for instance, here's one, okay? The existence of God, God is all-powerful and all-wise, level one. The immortality of the soul, level two. The Trinity, level three. Andy.
I noticed the use of the word supernatural in question 23. So is there some delineation between supernatural revelation and revelation in Romans chapter
2? No. Supernatural there is not a synthetic but an analytic term. You analyze the term revelation and it has in it supernatural.
Okay.
That's part of
by
the
definition.
Term. Yes, by definition. David.
Why does the chart here would we conclude that revelation is special revelation?
Yes, all revelation is special revelation in Roman Catholic dogma. See, there's no distinction between general and special. That's a distinctively Protestant distinction. Very interesting. It's either reason or revelation. What you can know by reason. So, in regard to the Thomistic view, see, Thomistic, you understand Thomas Aquinas, Thomistic. Again, we're trying to be literate here. What's the Thomistic view? And therefore, since Thomas is the doctor of the Roman Catholic Church, what's the Thomistic view of natural theology? Is unaided human reason able to formulate theologically significant propositions concerning God? Answer, yes. But only on level one and a little bit on level two. In other words, on a rather basic level, yes. So the answer is yes and no, depending on which level you're operating. Okay? Some truths can be known by unaided human reason, others cannot. There's a simple summary answer. Now, what that has suggested to a number of people is that human reason has not really been all that affected by the fall. That's what it suggests to a number of people looking at the Roman Catholic dogma concerning natural theology. So, when we talk about what is called noetic effects of sin. Noetic, nous, the mind. You're talking about the effects of sin on the reason, on the mind. Well, you can see that that really doesn't seem to come into play in the Roman Catholic theology. The noetic effects of sin. Because in none of those is sin a problem in any of the three levels. Did you notice that? Sin is not a problem in any level. It's a question of whether it's revealed or isn't revealed. If it isn't revealed, the question is, can it be known by reason? So unaided reason here is reason unaffected by sin. The view of John Calvin. Now, you read through this material. Some of it is rather poetic almost in the language that he employs. Do you understand that when we quote from the institutes, or originally institutions of the Christian religion, this work now in the MacNeil edition is published in two good-sized volumes. It's a fairly big chunk of material. When Calvin first published this in 1536, it was eight chapters long. No, excuse me, six chapters. It was six chapters long. And it was written for new believers. Well, you'd have to read the 1536 edition. By the way, it's now available. It's published, the 1536 edition. After all, a number of people were being converted, you see, and a number of people needed help in growth in their Christian understanding. And so he wrote this small treatise of six chapters. Well, by the time you get to 1556, it had burgeoned to 80 chapters. Edition after edition after edition, and not simply in French, but also in Latin and in some other languages as well. And yet it was originally written, you should understand that, for new Christians. Well, this, of course, represents the more mature development of the institutes. What does Calvin say? Well, first of all, he does affirm general revelation. He says, general revelation does exist. God does reveal himself. And he reveals himself rather marvelously. Wonderfully. In 1:5:11 at the bottom of page 112, the Lord represents both himself and his everlasting kingdom, that is, his lordship over all creation, in the mirror of his work with very great clarity. Very great clarity. And in 1:5:14, page 113, he speaks of so many burning lamps shine for us. And in line 3, they bathe us wholly in their radiance. And in 1:6:1, he speaks of that brightness which is born in upon the eyes of all men, both in heaven and on earth. And is it sufficient? Why, of course it's sufficient. It's more than sufficient to withdraw all support from men's ingratitude. Well, if it's so clear, if it's so sufficient, in other words, if we can speak of clarity, and if we can speak of perspicuity, That is, it's understandable, it's graspable. And if we can speak of sufficiency, those three characteristics which are so frequently applied to Scripture, clarity, perspicuity, sufficiency. If we can say those things of general revelation, then does it not follow that human beings can know God through simply opening their eyes, through simply looking, through simply letting the revelation pour in upon them day and night, as Psalm 19 says? There's a problem, Calvin says. The problem is sin. The problem is sin. What has sin done? Well, sin motivates us to do what? Well, in 1:5:11, at the bottom of page 112, line 3, he says, "Such is our stupidity that we grow increasingly dull towards so manifest tendencies, and they flow away without profiting us. Sometimes we're driven to contemplate God." Page 113. "This of necessity happens to all men. But after we rashly grasp a conception of some sort of divinity, straightway we fall back into the ravings or evil imaginings of our flesh and corrupt by our vanity the pure truth of God." In one respect, we're all unalike. Each one of us privately forges his own particular error. Yet we're very much alike in that one and all we forsake the one true God for prodigious trifles. I like that, that juxtaposition, prodigious trifles. Look at 1:14. "It is therefore in vain that so many burning lamps shine for us." It's in vain. "Although they bathe us wholly in their radiance, yet they can of themselves in no way lead us into the right path. They strike some sparks, but before their fuller light shines, these are smothered." He says we don't have the eyes to see this unless our eyes be illumined by the inner revelation of God through faith. The inner revelation. 1:5:15. "Though we lack the natural ability to mount up under the pure and clear knowledge of God." Now there it's quite plain. We lack the natural ability to mount up into the pure and clear knowledge of God. Does that excuse us? No. All excuses cut off because the fault of dullness is within us. It's within us. What do we do with it? On 1:5:15, about two-thirds of the way down, "At the same time as we have enjoyed a slight taste of the divine from contemplation of the universe, having neglected the true God, we raise up in his stead dreams and specters of our own brains, and attribute to anything else than the true source the praise of righteousness, wisdom, goodness, and power. We snatch away from them," God's daily acts, "their glory, and from their author his due praise." Now there's another problem. There's another problem. And it's compounded by sin. That is, how are we going to understand the general revelation aright unless we have the special revelation to guide us? The special revelation in Scripture. However, in order to read that revelation, we need spectacles, glasses. I thought that was very interesting in 1536 and 1556 and 9 to read about spectacles. I thought that was kind of interesting. I went down to the Franklin Institute and I discovered that Ben Franklin, you know. But then I said, wait a minute. Ben Franklin is much later. He's in the late 1700s, and here's Calvin writing in the 1500s about spectacles. Isn't that interesting? Just as older, bleary-eyed men and those with weak vision, if you thrust before them a most beautiful volume, 161, even if they recognize it to be some sort of writing, that's what happens when I take my glasses off. I recognize this to be some sort of writing, but I can't really read what it says. Yet can scarcely construe two words, but with the aid of spectacles will begin to read distinctly. So Scripture, gathering up the otherwise confused knowledge of God in our minds, having dispersed our dullness, clearly shows us the true God. So God not merely uses mute teachers, general revelation. It communicates a message, but it doesn't speak with a language. Mute teachers. He also opens his own most hallowed lips through Scripture. Not only does he teach the elect to look upon a God, but he also shows himself as the God upon whom they are to look. That's interesting. So, Calvin affirms general revelation. He denies that man is able to formulate a true natural theology. And if he's going to read general revelation correctly, he needs the spectacles of Scripture. Those 3 points. Now, the view of Emil Brunner. I've quoted somewhat copiously here on pages 114 and 115 from the Christian Doctrine of God, volume 1 of the Dogmatics, from appendix to chapter 12. But all I've quoted is section 1, 2, 3, 6, and 7. So in order to fill in the gap, I've given you a handout, appendix to chapter 12, entitled The Natural Knowledge of God, The Problem of the Theologia Naturalis, Natural Theology. So there you have the whole thing, including the sections I didn't include in that copious excerpt. Now, this is so well said that I really think it's worth looking at rather closely. However, before we do that, let me mention something. In 1934, Emil Brunner published a work entitled Natur und Gnade, Nature and Grace. In it, he unfortunately used the term a Christian theologia naturalis, a Christian natural theology. The next year, Karl Barth, who didn't miss a thing, Karl Barth issued a reply to Emil Brunner. And the reply was just one word. Nine. No. Now, these two works, that is a somewhat abridged version of Natur und Gnade, which is a whole book, and Barth's response, Nein, Ein Antwort an Emil Brunner, these were bound together in a work entitled Natural Theology. And this appeared in 1946, but the two were bound together. I was dumbfounded that it is not in our library, and I'm going to try to make certain that it gets into our library, this work. It's very important. Barth, as we've already seen, not only rejected the natural theology, quote, of Rome, unquote, but also rejected general revelation. Barth said, there's only one revelation, that's Jesus Christ. There is no revelation in creation as such. Well, this was a bone of contention between Brunner and Barth for many years, many years. They parted on that note in 1935, and they really didn't meet again until 1951, when an American professor from a Presbyterian seminary set up a meeting between the two. He felt that the thing had lasted long enough. So he got them together, Dr. Barth and his wife, and Dr. Brunner and his wife, got them together, and they were reconciled. But it was a long, drawn-out controversy. They did not really change their views, but at least personally, they were reconciled. Now, from time to time, I've mentioned just what I mentioned today, that this is so well written that it's worthwhile looking at. I still have a student who from time to time calls me from various places, and he calls me at all kinds of hours. He'll call me from Denver at 3 in the morning, or Chicago, or wherever, and he calls me, and the first thing he asks is my health. But the second thing, he lectures me, he exhorts me, that I must not say anything good about Brunner. Well, I appreciate his calling me about my health at 3 in the morning. But I assure him that I have tried on various occasions to point out that Brunner is not a safe guide to the teaching of Scripture. He's not a sound teacher of doctrine, but that some of the things that Brunner says are very well said, and much clearer than Barth, much clearer. What he says here is quite well said. Again, see, I'm saying something good about Brunner, so I may hear about this again. Well, would you look with me at this, please, for just a few moments? If you understand this chapter, you'll probably understand the whole of natural theology, this section. That it encompasses that much of a range. Now, would you follow, please? I won't do this often. In recent times, and rightly, the question whether, from the standpoint of the Christian faith, God can be known outside the historical revelation is to be answered in the affirmative or in the negative, is now regarded as a fundamental problem, and like few other problems of this kind, has led to varied and passionate controversies. The very fact of the passionate feeling which has been aroused, a display of emotion which in itself may be deplored, and with which this conflict has been waged, shows that we are here dealing with a decisive question of the first importance. But here, too, the passionate concern for clarity of thought has not always been an advantage. It has indeed led to misunderstandings and misinterpretations which create grave hindrances to the clarification of the problem. Since I myself, by the use of a misleading idea, am bound to admit that I have caused some of the chief misunderstanding, I feel obliged to make yet another attempt to clear up the difficulty. First of all, we must make a clear distinction between two questions which unfortunately are continually being confused with one another. The question of the revelation in creation, that's general revelation, and the question of man's natural knowledge of God, natural theology. While one side was mainly anxious to deny the validity of a theologia naturalis, the other side was chiefly concerned to affirm the reality of the revelation in creation. Now, some theologians believed, mistakenly, that their denial of a theologia naturalis obliged them also to deny the reality of the revelation in creation. If they denied natural theology, they felt they had to deny general revelation. Because Barth, for example, felt that if you admitted general revelation, it led inevitably to the natural theology of Rome. This was due to their mistaken idea that the acknowledgement of a revelation in creation must necessarily lead to the recognition of a teologia naturalis. I myself, however, helped to foster this mistaken equation of the revelation of creation with natural theology, which I contested from the very outset, to this extent, that in the first edition of Natur und Gnade, Nature and Grace, I described the Christian doctrine of the revelation of creation by the misleading expression of a Christian teologia naturalis. On the other side, however, it's evident that the correction of this unfortunate phrase, to which I drew special attention in the second edition of this brochure, that is, Natur und Gnade, second edition, has not been noticed. The affirmation of a revelation creation has in itself nothing whatever to do with a belief in natural theology. A theology which intends to remain true to the biblical witness to revelation should never have denied the reality of revelation and creation. All efforts to contest the biblical evidence for such a revelation must lead to an arbitrary exegesis and to forced interpretations of the text of the Bible. Here he's referring specifically to Barth's treatment of Psalm 19 and Romans 1. He felt those were distortions. But even apart from explicit biblical evidence, the Christian idea of the Creator should itself force us to admit the reality of a revelation of creation. For what sort of Creator would not imprint the mark of His Spirit upon His creation? 2. The question whether the natural man, that is, the man who has not yet been affected by the historical revelation, is in a position to perceive this divine revelation and creation as such, in accordance with its nature and its meaning, is a quite different question. Okay, if you affirm general revelation, then the next question is, can man perceive it? But not just perceive it, can he perceive it correctly? Can he perceive it correctly? This question, therefore, has not been answered when we have answered the former question in the affirmative. That is, we've said yes to general revelation. Because between the revelation of creation and the natural man, there stands the fact of sin. If it is a mistake, and from the standpoint of the Bible and theology, an impossibility to contest the reality of the revelation of creation, it is no less mistaken to deny the negative significance of sin for the perception of the truth of the revelation in creation. Sin not only perverts the will, it also obscures the power of perceiving truth where the knowledge of God is concerned. Here you have it, right here, the noetic effects of sin. That's shorthand just for what all that Brunner has just said. So, where a man supports the view of the reality of a teologia naturalis in the sense of correct, valid knowledge, he's actually denying the reality of sin, or at least its effect in the sphere of man's knowledge of God. Thus, on the one hand, the reality of the revelation creation is to be admitted, but on the other hand, the possibility of a correct and valid natural knowledge of God is to be contested. Now, however, 3, the problem is complicated by the fact that when we have said that we must question the possibility of a valid knowledge of God to the natural man, we have not said all there is to say. There is, it is true, no valid natural theology, but there is a natural theology which in fact exists. What is this, a paradox? Is he just saying things to get us stirred up like Kierkegaard? No. The place to discuss this, that is, the natural theology which in fact exists, however, is not in connection with the doctrine of God, for here it has no theological validity, but in connection with the doctrine of man, for natural theology is an anthropological fact which no one can deny. Human beings, even those who know nothing of the historical revelation, meaning Scripture, are such that they cannot help forming an idea of God and making pictures of God in their minds. The history of the religions of mankind provides incontrovertible evidence of this fact. The formation of theological ideas is an empirical fact of the reality of sinful humanity. That is a fact that can be arrived at by simple experience. This fact cannot be denied. All that we can contest is how it should be interpreted. From the standpoint of the Christian faith, on the basis of biblical testimony, how are we to interpret this fact? The chief passage in the Bible which deals with this question, Romans 1:19 following, gives the interpretation which alone can stand the test of theological examination. The fact that sinful human beings cannot help having thoughts about God is due to the revelation in creation. Isn't that an interesting statement? Human beings can't help having ideas about God because of the revelation in creation. That suggests that when man is and has been sometimes denominated as homo religiosus, that man is religious, that's part of his makeup, part of his outlook, that's true. But it's true, he says, to the fact of the revelation in creation. The other fact that human beings are not able rightly to understand the nature and meaning of this revelation creation is due to the fact that their vision has been distorted by sin. Once again, the noetic effects of sin. Sin obscures men's vision to such an extent that in the place of God, they know or imagine gods, so that God's revelation and creation is turned into lying pictures of idols. Quote from his own work, first edition, Natur und Gnade. In this sentence, I tried to say three things. A, that the revelation of creation is a reality. B, that natural theology is a legitimate possibility, does not exist. And C, that the fact of natural theology is an empirical fact, something which belongs to the nature of the natural man, is understood in its ambiguity. But the doctrine of the apostle, in spite of its brevity, takes us a step further. 5. The apostle cannot be interested in the theoretical question, how are we to explain the theologia naturalis of the pagan sinful man or woman? But the question which interests him is this: how should we address the man to whom the message of Jesus is to be proclaimed? This question he answers thus: sinful man is responsible for his sin because in the revelation creation, the possibility is given him of knowing God. He is responsible for his idolatry. He is anapologetos, without excuse. Comes from apologeo, and with the negative in front of it. Thus, according to the biblical teaching, the doctrine of general revelation becomes actual in anthropology. Human responsibility is based upon the general revelation. Paul says, so that man is inexcusable. The quality that makes man human is derived from the revelation in creation, from the relation which God established at the very outset between man and the Creator. That speaks, of course, of the image and that relationship. Responsible existence, that is, the existence of man in contrast to that of every other creature, is his existence as person. All other creatures that God created, except, of course, angelic and demonic beings, are not persons. Human beings are persons. Even sinful man does not cease to be a responsible person. This responsible personal existence, which is grounded in the creation, cannot be lost. It is very cheering to note that Karl Barth, in his exposition of the narrative of the creation of Genesis 1:26 following, has come to the same conclusion. The fact that man has been created in the image of God, taught in this passage, means responsible existence, the thou relation with the Creator, which is the basis of the thou relation with one's fellow man. And this fact, namely that we've been created in the image of God, cannot be lost. Quoting from the Church Dogmatics of Karl Barth. Cannot be lost. That's interesting as well. In other words, the image persists, however damaged. The fall does not mean that man ceases to be responsible, but that he ceases to understand his responsibility aright and to live according to his responsibility. Sin, far from eliminating responsibility, and thus this vestige of the imago Dei, the image of God, is on the contrary a witness to God-willed responsibility, just as the sinful illusion of idolatry is a witness to the God-given revelation of creation. That's interesting. Idolatry is a witness to God's revelation. Isn't that interesting? Of course, there's some steps in between, you understand, between God's revelation and idolatry. Those steps that Paul mentions in Romans 1. Suppression of the truth, perversion of the truth, exchange of the truth of a lie, and then construction of lying idols. There are some steps in between. The idolatrous images of man, whether they be the massive structures of wood or brass, or the idolatrous abstractions of speculative theology, accuse man because to him has been given another possibility of the knowledge of God. It is sin which makes idols out of the revelation and creation. 6. This biblical view of the natural man and of his theologia naturalis can and must be examined in the light of historic fact. What is the result of this examination? The history of religion shows that mankind cannot help producing religious ideas and carrying on religious activities. You get that chiefly through cultural anthropology, the study of comparative religions as well, that man everywhere on the planet is religious, some form of religion. The multiplicity of religious ideas of God and of the gods is so vast and so contradictory that it is impossible to gather it all up in one positive conception as the result of research. To reach such a result by a process of elimination is not the task of religion itself, but of philosophy. Whither it leads will be shown directly. Within this welter of religious conceptions of God, it is impossible to discover one common denominator. That's very interesting. Rudolf Otto, in his work, The Idea of the Holy, attempted to look at various world religions and to see if there was some common denominator. And he came to the conclusion that there is the idea of the numinous. The numinous, which we would probably call the transcendent, that idea. Watch, however, what Brunner says. The higher religions are contrasted with the primitive religions, and the contradictions are too great to be overcome. So Rudolf Otto, was not entirely successful in finding a common denominator among the world religions. There's no common element which could do justice at the same time, look at this, to the polytheistic personalism of the one and the monistic impersonalism of the other. Francis Schaeffer has said, there's no way to put together the impersonal, infinite religions of the East with the personal, finite religions of the West. There's no way to put those together. 7. From the beginning of Greek philosophy, men have continually tried to reach a clear and certain knowledge of God, not along the path of religion, but by the way of philosophy, by speculative thought, and thus to overcome the irrationalism of the purely religious formation of ideas. These philosophical doctrines of God now confront one another in irreconcilable opposition. Above all, none of them can possibly be combined with the Christian idea of God. The relation of the God of Plato or of Aristotle with the God of the biblical revelation is that of the either-or. Using Kierkegaard's distinction, the either-or. Totally other. The same may be said of every other idea of God which has been attained purely by philosophical speculation. The reason for this will be given in the next chapter. The God of thought must differ from the God of revelation. The God who is conceived by thought, conceived, brought into existence by thought, is not the one who discloses himself. From this point of view, he is an intellectual idol. Now, I've got to say, that's well said. That's well said. Come on. That's well said. I wish I had said that. That's well said. David.
I struggle a little bit with the question I put this morning because it seems in the notes that you gave a definition.
You're correct.
Do you think the natural theology is a unbiblical concept? Still need to know how to define it.
Well, yeah, we haven't quite finished with this yet. But you still have to know how to define it, because it has a tremendous history in theology, especially in the Church of Rome. And books have been written about it. We really need to know what is meant by natural theology. So that's why I emphasize the definition. On the midterm?
Yeah.
Let's look at that for a moment, since it is the time it is. Very nice lead-in, David. Very nice lead-in. Yes. There, I'm simply looking for the formal definitions that are given.
The one sentence, right?
That's it, yeah. Yeah. See, that's an easy 6 points. And since we're there, let's continue. What other questions do you have on the call?
Number seven.
Scott, would you turn that down just for a moment, please? Well, it may seem brief, but it's sufficient. I would think so. It's kind of neat because if someone asks you, you can spot what is the thread that on which they all hang together, and you can say it briefly and quickly. You can then, of course, out of the vast treasure of your knowledge and expertise, expand on those, but that's not necessary for this purpose. Yes, good. Thank you, Paul. Thank you. Brian.
I have a question for number 16.
Oh, boy. Yes.
Well, if you want to base your reflection on the doctrine of formulation and implications for the 1 and 9 and 1 and 10, we have to work on, say, at least 20 different points. And do you expect us to support each point with the scriptural evidence?
Well, it says supporting them from Scripture. I suspect that since there are only 4 Scriptures involved in external and 4 in internal, and there are really 2 main ones in external, and really mostly 1 main one in internal, right? Yeah. It's fairly simple to use those bases for support. I mean, you don't have to go all over the place to find support. They're right there. I mean, the support is right there. And some of the... And obviously, material in those passages supports a number of those ideas. And therefore, you can use the same scriptural support as long as it supports. That cuts it down some. Ed... Oh, you're going to cut it down? Cut it down more?
would it be proper to say, as I synthesize these scriptures and name those scriptures, I arrive at these conclusions regarding external?
No, that would not be sufficient. Now, you have to be specific. You have to be specific. You don't have to be prolix, but you have to be specific. You don't have to write a lot additional, as Paul says. You don't have to write a lot additional stuff that's not really necessary, but you do have to support it specifically. Don't give me just references so that I have to look up the references. Tell me what in the references supports the ideas. By the way, here's a little trick. If you want a little trick, here's a little trick. On pages 1-9 and 1-10, particularly 1-9, but of course the bottom of 1-9 runs over a little bit on 1-10. You notice there are 7 statements under both external and internal. Did you notice there's a pattern to those statements? Did you notice there's a parallel between the two sets? Boy, it gets easier and easier. I mean, if you follow the pattern, it sort of unfolds out naturally. For instance, an external on page 109. Let me make it very brief. Under 4A1, it says, yes, there is such a thing. And all you have to do is define it. What do you mean? There is such a thing. Number 2, what does it reveal? Excuse me, no. How does it reveal? I'm sorry. How does it reveal? Number 3, what does it reveal? Number 4, is it wiped out by sin? Number 5, how far does it extend? Number 6, is it perceived? Does it get to people? And number 7, what do they do with it? Now there it is, right there. There's the whole pattern. Now, isn't that simple? And then you go to B, internal. Yes, there is. Definition, what is it? How does it reveal God? What does it reveal of God? Is it wiped out by sin? How far does it reach? Is it perceived? Is it known? And what do people do with it? See, once again, it's very simple. If you put it in just a few tag words, then the whole rest of it just opens up for you. Even if you've just read it over a few times, it opens up for you. Paul.
A lot of what they said, by answering those 7 questions, also overlaps with the 6 implications.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, so it's not necessary to be spelled exact.
No. No. You're right. There's a lot of overlap. A lot of overlap. A lot. Well, but the thing is, on page 110, Paul.
Yeah, there's the thing about salvation.
That's right. That's important.
Yeah.
What it does. Yeah. That's right. That's right. Not everything, but a lot.
And, well, being said that you could say these 7, 8 or so points in not all that lengthy of discussion, but on the other hand, what 40 points in my opinion, liberal on one lengthy discussion.
You have to explain it. Yeah. You have to support it by scripture. You have to explain it, what you mean, and support it.
It's open Bible.
It is open Bible, yeah. Yes, correct. Correct. I'm not trying to deliberately shorten your answer, but I am trying to simplify the way to get at it by giving tag words to these ideas. Other questions? Paul again.
Number 13.
Ah, yes, the other bugbear.
Explanation. You propose a method that
I don't know as I would characterize it as loose, but... Rather than loose, let's say comprehensive.
So when you ask for a theological message, you're not asking for step one, or just step two, or three. You said you're asking.
No.
I guess so. This kind of approach used to be kind of sentence and reason.
Yeah, the other day, Paul, I suggested that on page 92, it mainly deals with the theoretics and the second, third, and fourth paragraphs, whereas on page 91, it gives a concrete illustration of how the method is used. And you can approach it from either standpoint. However, since the theoretics are more abstract, you need to perhaps do a little more explaining with the theoretical approach than you do with the practical application approach. So I say that as a sort of a guide. Ed. Just briefly define them, yes. Mm-hmm. Once again, don't assume I know anything. Gloria.
Four.
Yes, capital L. Yes. That's Scott? Six. They are.
And the other question I had was on number 12. You said yesterday in explaining God's work, memory position, that we had to explain Russia's doctrine. I went back to the belt and wasn't anything about Russia's doctrine per se. Is that theological lesson?
On page 80, describes there both before and after that diagram what retroduction is all about, how one goes about it. Well, in the second paragraph, line 4, it's speaking of retroduction, and this whole thing is retroduction. Paul again. Yeah, and the problem is what the exegesis does theologically in terms of creating or not creating a contradiction internally. It creates a theological problem if you translate it one way. So in other words, the theology is based on the exegesis one way or the other, depending on how you translate. Other questions? Okay, let's go back to page 116, following. Uh-huh. Now, you've read this definition. Natural theology consists of those theologically significant propositions formulated by unaided human reason. And then a little expansion of that. And a distinction made between reasoning, the process of reasoning, and the faculty of reason. And how sin has affected or does affect both. Then some biblical teaching, which you've read, especially a number of instances which could be multiplied from the Old Testament concerning the construction of idols. Did you notice on page 117 in Ezekiel 14 the very significant reference in verse 7? Anyone of the house of Israel or of the immigrants who stay in Israel who separates himself from me, that's a first step, then sets up his idols in his heart. Did you notice that? That's where idolatry always begins. And then he puts right before his face the stumbling block of his iniquity. That's a third step. And then he comes to the prophet to inquire of me for himself. That's adding insult to injury. Notice, the person separates himself from God, sets up idols in his heart, and then constructs the idols. Or places the idols before his face. Now the idols take physical form. Now it's an interesting question whether in a technological age whether people still have idols and what forms those idols take. That's an interesting question. Do people still construct lying idols? That is, idols which are contrary to the truth? Now, one might say, well, in some parts of the world, they still let those idols take physical form. But surely not in technologically advanced societies and cultures. Well, I'm not so sure that that's the case. What are some idols? Let's think for just a minute. What are some idols that people construct today? By idols, of course, we mean, let's see what we do mean. Let's analyze it for a minute. What do we mean by idols? Is that something that takes the place of God as far as ultimate allegiance and devotion? Is that something we trust in and perhaps trust in ultimately? Is that something we love more than anything else in the world? Is that something to which we give, as it were, religious devotion, ultimate devotion? Are there idols like that? Do people have idols like that? Can you think of any? Andy, can you think of any?
Yeah, I'm sitting here nodding. I have a very dear friend who just came to the Lord last fall. He's one of the very successful business executives, and one of the things that helped to bring him to the Lord was he sold a company. He had developed himself for a lot of money, but proceeded to put a beautiful wing on him in the town. And for his time, his energy,
nothing wrong with a beautiful house.
Absolutely. But he came to realize, in fact, they referred him to Ecclesiastes.
They referred him what?
I referred him to Ecclesiastes.
Yes.
He said, it's totally amazing. He said,
Anybody else? Can you think of idols that people construct today? Or that people set up in their hearts, perhaps before their faces? No. No risk. David, did you have a thought?
Oh, yeah,
Sports. Susan. Entertainment figures. Bianca. What's the idol? Success?
Academic success.
Even in seminary? You are joking. Susan. More instead of fewer. Isn't that interesting? Someone else had a hand. Nan? That's Brian.
I read some articles saying Time or some newspapers that American people are trying to go back to some spirituality from materialism. But when you look into what kind of spirituality, you know, it's a lot of things that say New Age things.
Yeah.
And people physically build some altar in their living room, in the bedroom, you know, with some. They're physically building up some idols these days.
David, and then Ed. Brian. No. Someone else. I'm sorry, Ed.
I'm trying to think of like the word death and real bottom line. I think pleasure or comfort.
That's a very big one. Very powerful motivators, yes. In the in Korea, are there still altars, but in the houses? And temples? Are there temples in Korea?
A lot of temples.
A lot of temples. Now, are we speaking Buddhism, Hinduism? Not so much, no. Buddhism, yeah.
But recently, actually, you know, in America, as Christians, you know, we can distinct like the real born again Christian. But in a church, just going enough.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Nominal Buddhists, like nominal Roman Catholics or nominal Protestants. That's right. Nominal Christians, yeah. There was a woman once in Elkins Park when I was teaching at Faith Seminary. She was elderly. And I know how the elderly become attached to pets. And pets can be very beneficial for the elderly. We know that. But her dog died. And she wanted to die. She wanted to die. I could never quite square that. I could understand a very close attachment to a pet. But I could never quite understand that equation of value with, as it were, a human life. I couldn't understand. Of course, I can't speak from experience as far as age is. No. Yeah. In key. Bruce.
Whole basis of her life is that she's happy.
Physical beauty is a very big idol in the United States. And, of course, popularity and youth. And, of course, wealth, material possession. David. On page 117, I suggest that a valid natural theology based on unaided human reason, on the one hand, is not possible, but on the other hand, is, as Brunner says, a fact, an anthropological fact. That is, people do create their own idols in their own hearts. All over the world, wherever you go. Now, of course, there are some exceptions. Someone would say, what about atheists? I mean, they don't seem to have any conception of God except one they perhaps may be fighting against. What about them? My professor in research at Lehigh University said something very interesting. I don't know how much weight we can put on it, but he said something interesting. He was in Texas at a convention. I don't know what the convention theme was, but he was there and he spoke to a rather prominent surgeon. And the surgeon quipped to him. He says, I've been a surgeon a long time. He says, I've never met an atheist on the operating table. That's interesting. That's interesting. Again, how much weight you can put on that is another question, but... Yes, yes, yes. Yes, exactly. When they face the ultimate issue. Yeah. Yes, Ed.
I'm having a hard time reconciling A... individual theologically significant propositions formulated through general revelation, but not a total theology.
That we want to talk about. We'll pick that up next time, Lord willing, when we pick up this the last two statements there on page 117 under C. And then look at the chart briefly. Then we'll quickly move on to special revelation scripture. Okay?